So let me just give you some advice. It doesn't come from Scripture, but comes from kids. I thought I'd just read this for you. Maybe you can derive some benefit from it. This was taken from a survey that was given to kids about marriage and what they know about it. So here's one question that was asked. How do you decide who to marry? Alan, age 10, said, you've got to find somebody who likes the same stuff. Like, if you like sports, she should like it that you like sports, and she should keep the chips and dip coming. Kristen, age 10, said, no person really decides before they grow up who they're going to marry. God decides it all the way before, and you get to find out later who you're stuck with. One of the questions was, how can a stranger tell if two people are married? And Derek, age 8, said, you might have to guess based on whether they seem to be yelling at the same kids. So that's one way you can tell. Another question was, what do you think your mom and dad have in common? And Lori, age 8, said, both don't want any more kids. There was a question, what do you think most people do on a date? Give you a couple of the, one of the answers here is from Martin, age 10. He said, on the first date, they just tell each other lies, and that usually gets them interested enough to go for a second date. And if you've been on dates, you know that's pretty much true, right? Is it better to be single or married? Anita, age 9, says, it's better for girls to be single, but not for boys. Boys need someone to clean up after them. She's pretty bang on. And the last one was, how would you make a marriage work? Ricky, age 10, said, tell your wife that she looks pretty, even if she looks like a dump truck. So there's some killer marriage tips for you. Well, I want to begin just by kind of reviewing. It's been a little bit since we talked this morning, but just to review what we talked about this morning, I gave you one sentence to kind of sum up that first session. So does anyone remember what that sentence was? Anyone help me out with that? Anybody paying attention at all in the first session? Okay, a great marriage really is a priceless treasure. The second half of that was? Right, but just because you're married doesn't mean you've got a priceless marriage. So what I want to do in this session is just to give you one sentence again that I think is kind of foundational to this, and that is, there's the review, here it is. A priceless marriage is not something you find, but something you build. And so we're going to talk a little bit about what it takes to build a priceless marriage in this session. And just at the outset, let me just say that there are really two different approaches to marriage ministry or to helping couples work on their marriages. One is what I would call the problem-centered approach. So this approach begins with asking the question, what problems do you have as a couple? And you make a list of the problems that you might have. Maybe it's communication, finances, whatever it is. And you make your way through that list and you try to fix them one by one. The other approach is one where you don't focus on your problems, but you focus on your marriage. And this approach begins with the question, what does it take to have the kind of marriage God designed us for? And then moving on to what do we need to do to have that kind of marriage together? So the first approach is about fixing something. The second one is about building something. I don't know about you, but I would much rather build something than try to fix something. And that's the approach we will take in this session, really about building something and building it together. And that's the approach I think you ought to take in your marriage as well. So again, a priceless marriage is not something you find, it's something you build. Just as a way to kind of illustrate the importance of this, I want to just share a story that comes from a friend of mine that's written a book, Gary Thomas. His book is called Pure Pleasure. It's not a book about marriage, but I think there's a really good application out of the way he begins this book. And he talks about going for a run. He is a runner, going for a run while he was in Houston. He said, Houston sweltered in clammy humidity while the summer sun baked the streets with 95-degree heat. It was smack dab in the middle of the afternoon, and every sane person sat cool and refreshed inside an air-conditioned house. Some, no doubt, felt startled by an eminently foolish, middle-aged, fluorescent white man from the Pacific Northwest melting in his running shoes as he trekked through the suburbs. I had been invited by two churches to visit Texas, and since I was to preach on Sunday morning and then lead a staff retreat that evening, my run had to be shoehorned in on Sunday afternoon between the two morning sermons and the evening session. Because of the heat, I planned to run just 6 miles. I took no water with me, but hey, the entire run would take less than 50 minutes. I figured, how thirsty could I get? In less than 15 minutes, I found out. Imagine chewing on hot sand for 10 minutes, spitting it out, and then letting someone blow the air of a hairdryer directly down your throat for another 5. That's what it felt like. Unfortunately, I still had another half hour to go. 30 minutes into my run, I felt like a 90-year-old man when a discarded, half-consumed bottle of Diet Coke lying in a ditch started to look inviting. I knew I was in trouble. Finally, I saw a woman walking in front of her house, a house that had a hose rolled up in front of it. I walked up to her and through a parched throat croaked out, "Excuse me, would you mind if I take a quick drink from your hose?" "Not at all," she said. So I turned on the hose and let it run for a moment. I opened my mouth to receive the most plastic-tasting, mineral-encrusted water you can imagine. Think about it. The water in that hose had boiled inside a rubber tube for days. The bacteria were probably multiplying by the millisecond, no doubt falling over themselves in their rush to reproduce. As that water coursed down my throat, a small voice in the back of my mind said, "You are so going to pay for this. 3 hours from now, you're going to wish you were dead." And he shares that story about going for a run and suddenly being in the midst of that, finding this discarded half-drank bottle of Coke inviting, and the water from this garden hose appealing to him. But he goes on to say, 3 hours later when he was in a supermarket and there was a cooler full of refreshing beverages, there's no way any of those things would have been inviting to him at all. They wouldn't have posed any temptation to him at all. And the application to marriage is that when we concentrate on building a strong marriage, when we have a priceless marriage, it makes us far less likely to look for satisfaction outside of it. Now, I think we understand that, but how do we get there as couples? How do we get to the place where we've built our marriage up to the point that there is nothing outside of it that is a threat to it? So I want to go back to Genesis chapter 2 to look at the specifics of how we actually do this. And I'm going to read verses 18 to 25 again. This is what it says. "The Lord God said, 'It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make a helper fit for him.' So out of the ground, the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the heavens and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. The man gave names to all the livestock and to the birds of the heavens and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper fit for him. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and while he slept, he took one of his ribs and closed up the place with flesh. And the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Then the man said, 'This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man.'" Verse 24, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." We're going to focus primarily in this session on verses 24 and 25 and really talk about this idea of oneness in marriage. What does it mean for a husband and wife to become one? Many people have looked at this over the years and said something like this: "I understand that the husband and wife become one, but which one do they become?" And that's really not the picture of what biblical oneness is in marriage. These verses tell us that we become one as husband and wife by leaving father and mother and cleaving to our spouse. And my experience working with couples has taught me that most of the problems that couples experience in their marriages are related either to not leaving or to not cleaving. You can't become one if you don't leave, and you can't become one if you don't cleave together. So I want to do something very simple in this session. I want to give you four pictures of oneness that come from this passage. So just kind of some visual images or some pictures that you can keep in your mind. The first picture of oneness is a couple standing back to back. So you can very easily picture that. And the key word for this picture is protection. The picture of a couple standing back to back is the picture of a couple determined to fend off whatever might threaten their relationship. There's a lot of threats to relationship. When I think about some of the small ones that come, I think about this story of a man who was telling his coworker. He said, last night I was home with my wife and I said to her, I never want to live in a vegetative state dependent on some machine and fluids from a bottle. If that ever happens, just pull the plug. And his friend asked, well, so what happened? And he said, well, she got up, unplugged the TV and threw out my beer. It's a picture of protection, right? This is something that was threatening the relationship and it had to be cut off. But obviously there's a much bigger aspect to it than that. Verse 24 is really where this comes from. It says, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother. And to leave your father and mother means far more than just separating yourself physically from your parents, moving out of their basement suite. It means doing that, but it means a lot more than that. The main idea communicated by leaving is a change in all of your relational priorities. So when you're born into a family, your family of origin is your first place of loyalty. But when you get married, everything changes. And you practice leaving by making your relationship with your spouse your top priority. So apart from God, you do not allow any other person or anything to assume top place in your life. So I want to just kind of get practical about this. What does it mean to leave? What does it look like? What does a back-to-back marriage look like? What is it that you need to protect your marriage from? And the answer is anything that challenges your first loyalty to your spouse and your marriage. And I think there's two main areas to be aware of. The first one is in the area of time. So we need to be careful that we don't allow work or other commitments to simply suck the life out of our marriages. The book of Deuteronomy gives this very practical instruction to new husbands. It says, when a man is newly married, he shall not go out with the army or be liable for any other public duty. He shall be free at home 1 year to be happy with his wife whom he has taken. Now, I have to confess, there have been stretches in my life where I've been the chief of sinners in regard to this aspect of time and allowing other commitments to creep in and kind of pull some of this out of marriage. I mentioned earlier that I teach our marriage preparation course, and as a result of that, I end up doing a lot of weddings. My summer calendar gets pretty full on weekends doing people's weddings, and we went through a long stretch where it seemed like the only time we went out together as a couple was to attend somebody's wedding and their reception or some other church function. Now, the motivation was good. We didn't want to offend anybody, but we've got four kids, and to get babysitting for that, you know, it doesn't happen all the time. And so we would arrange it, and it seemed like every time we went out, it was to attend some church function or someone's wedding. And finally, we had to get to the place where we just said, you know what, building our relationship together takes priority over whatever other commitments we might have. And so it takes priority over saying yes to all of those invitations. See, a back-to-back marriage is one where each person feels the freedom to say, you know what, I think we're too busy, or I think you're too busy, and this is pulling us apart. I need Ilona to do that for me. So as a practical tool today, we have a meeting every Sunday night, our calendar meeting. We kind of get everything on the table. This is what's coming up. What can we say yes to? What do we need to say no to? How do we prioritize our relationship and guard it in the area of time? It's a way to make sure that we carve out time to invest in our marriage. That's a back-to-back practice. And in marriage, you need to do that all the time. The other area we have to protect our relationship has to do with people. And to stand back-to-back in this area means that you do not allow other people to come in between you and your spouse. Now, in saying that, I don't mean just that you have to guard against the potential for affairs. You need to do that, and I'll get to that in a minute. But there are also some more subtle ways that other people can come in between you and your spouse. And sometimes that threat will come from family members. God tells us here that for this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife. You can't cleave if you don't leave. And I have seen marriages that have been torn apart as a result of family interference. Some people never leave. I mean, they may leave physically, but they don't leave emotionally, and everything gets tied back into the family, and the family still, in many ways, controls the strings and controls an individual in a relationship. I've talked to couples in their 40s and even into their 50s where they're still sort of dependent on that parent relationship. They haven't left, and that's why they're experiencing trouble in marriage. So you need to establish some boundaries. Those of you heading towards marriage now, I just encourage you, when you start out, set your boundaries early. These are our parameters. This is sort of where we're going to place some protection around our relationship so we don't get swallowed up by family commitments. I think friends can sometimes also pose a threat to your relationship. And you need to make sure that your friends do not badmouth your spouse. A good friend ought to encourage you in your marriage. And not everyone has friends like this. I used to coach soccer with a guy who had a group of friends that would sometimes kind of hang around. And you could just tell that they were bad news for this guy's marriage. Because just like the video talked about guys' weekends away, this is what they would do. A couple times a year, they'd take guys' weekends to Vegas. And as you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. But it wasn't a healthy situation for the marriage. And as an outsider, you could see it coming a mile away. But in the relationship, there was no sort of standard of, you know what, we need to guard against this and let's put some areas of protection around us. Again, there's nothing wrong with a guy's weekend away or a girl's weekend away, but we need to make sure that these things do not hinder our growth in marriage. So standing back to back means you don't allow anyone to come in between you and your spouse. Let me just say something unpopular to add to that. That includes your kids. So again, a number of you aren't there yet, you're not married yet, or you don't have kids yet. I love my kids. We've got four fantastic kids. I love them. I love to see them up until 8:30 at night. 8:30 is the time for them to go to bed and the time for my wife and I to be together. That's the way we need it because we need our time together. Now, I see couples all the time in my office who are in trouble in marriage, and many of them have just had kids. And what they've done is they have placed their kids above their marriage. Their life kind of revolves around their children. Even the sleeping arrangement gets changed and the baby ends up in the bed most nights and he's on the couch. And they wonder why there's no intimacy, there's no connection. You have to be careful around this. So again, I know it's future, but I just want to say always commit to put your relationship as a highest priority. This is why when you take a flight, there is the pre-flight announcement that tells parents, if the oxygen masks should fall from the roof, put yours on first, then put the one on for your child or children who are accompanying you. The reason is because if you're in a panic, if you're not looked after, you're not going to be of any help to your kids. One of the best gifts you can give to your children is for them to see you in a great marriage, to see how marriage is supposed to function. So guard against others in your relationship. And obviously, this includes the potential for affairs in relationship. to a young couple sometimes heading for marriage. And one of the issues that comes up is, you know what? She's got this friend. I mean, they've been friends a long time. And is this okay that she has a good friend who's a guy and all of that stuff? Generally, my answer is no, it's not. You need to have some protection. You don't want to have deep emotional ties with someone of the opposite sex who is not your spouse. You may disagree with that, but this often leads to trouble. So be careful around that. So this is the back-to-back stuff. Back-to-back means you protect your relationship. You fend off whatever might threaten it, and you have open conversations around it. Second way for you to picture oneness is to picture it as a couple simply standing side by side. And the key idea in this aspect of oneness is companionship. In verse 21, it says that the Lord fashioned the woman from the man's rib. And the word that's translated rib here is the Hebrew word salah. It literally means side. That's how the word is translated in every other use in the Old Testament. Matthew Henry captures something of the significance of this when he says, "Woman was not made out of man's head to top him, nor out of his feet to be trampled upon by him, but out of his side to be equal to him, under his arm to be protected, and near his heart to be loved." Now, that's not a trite idea in marriage. A couple standing side by side is a good picture of what biblical oneness looks like. The book of Ecclesiastes gives us a good reminder about the importance of relationships when it says two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Guys, that's always a good verse to quote if you're sent to the couch. Goes on to say, "And though a man might prevail against one who is all alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken." Now, that passage is not directly aimed at marriage, but it contains some applicable truth for marriage. The picture there is the picture of the benefit that comes when two people face all of life together. It's ups, it's downs, it's joys, and it's struggles. And that's what companionship looks like. Now, this idea of a side-by-side marriage seems like a very simple idea, but some couples almost live separate lives. Instead of becoming one, the two remain two. He has his hobbies and interests and TV shows, she has hers. I think just the importance of shared experiences is something that you do in this side-by-side dimension of your marriage. And the importance of shared experiences, something that really hit home for me the first time that I went to Chicago. Now, I have this crazy ambition to watch a baseball game in every major league stadium. This wasn't a marriage-building weekend. This was actually a guy's weekend away, sports weekend. And I went to Wrigley Field for the first time. It is a magical place. It's a great place to watch baseball. And I was there with two friends, but it was late September. The Cubs were in a pennant race, and the only seats we could get, they were all in the same section, but in different rows. So we could kind of see each other from a distance, but we were separate. Wrigley Field is a great place to watch a baseball game, but who wants to watch a baseball game by themselves? And so as the game went on, we kind of finagled some things. We managed to get together. And it's just this great memory that the three of us have of attending a game in Wrigley Field together. I don't remember who won, but I have great memories because it was a shared experience. Now, the same thing is true in marriage. Your marriage is strengthened as you build memories together. There's tremendous power in just spending time and doing things together. If you want to have a strong marriage, you need to do some things together. Build your friendship. Create memories together. Even if you don't enjoy some of the activities with the same enthusiasm. My wife doesn't enjoy baseball the same way that I do, but she's always a good sport. On holidays, she knows we'll probably attend a baseball game wherever we are in the city. Her response is, if it's important to you, it's important to me. It's a side-by-side practice that, hey, we're going to build some memories and do some things together. Early in our marriage, we read a book entitled A Severe Mercy. It's the story of Sheldon and Davy Van Auken. This is a couple that was converted in the ministry of C.S. Lewis, his writing ministry. And the book describes their relationship and what their marriage looked like. And one of the key principles that we took away from that book was the need to guard against what they called creeping separateness. Creeping separateness refers to the way that couples often slowly kind of drift away from each other. And so as a way to guard against creeping separateness in their marriage, they instituted a number of practices in their relationship. And one of their principles was that if one of them read a book, the other one would read it. If one of them was doing one thing, the other would come along and learn what this is about. Now, we haven't applied that rigidly in our lives. I'm not sure Ilona would enjoy all of the books that I read, but it's something that we do from time to time. I just gave her a book on the Reformation that she's been reading, and we kind of share something of that together and build knowledge of what each other is about. And I've read some of her stuff as well. It's good practice just to find those things and build memories and kind of strengthen that side of your relationship. So my encouragement to you as a couple is to guard against that creeping separateness, to guard against pulling apart, finding your own interests and your own things you like to do. Let me give you a third picture of biblical oneness. It is the picture of a couple standing front to back. Now, the two key words in this expression of oneness are leadership and submission. I think this is probably the least understood and least appreciated idea of what biblical oneness is supposed to look like, maybe the most unpopular, but this is a thoroughly biblical idea. In verse 18, God says, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make a helper fit for him." Now, people read that verse differently, right? A guy who is a chauvinist would read that and say, "See, you exist to help me." Feminist will come to it and say, "No, that shows that you need help." Now, when we come to that verse, that word, the word helper does not mean inferior to. As a matter of fact, the word helper is most commonly used in reference to God himself. God is our helper. So understand, helper does not refer to weakness, but it actually refers to strength. I cannot help my kids with their homework if I don't have the knowledge to be able to do that in math or whatever area of study it is. The word as it is used here in Genesis 2 refers to the way it is supposed to be, that a wife is supposed to be a complement to her husband. She is to help him fulfill the mandate that God has given him. Now, I said this is a misunderstood dimension of Christian marriage. So I want to spend a bit of time just unpacking what this is supposed to look like from Ephesians chapter 5. I'm going to read Ephesians 5, 22 to 32. It says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church. Because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband." Well, I said this is a misunderstood dimension of a Christian marriage, so I want to spend just a couple minutes talking about this. I'm not going to comment on all of the verses from Ephesians 5, but I want to say a brief word to husbands And then a brief word to wives. Husbands are called to lead. And this very idea can cause some tension in relationships. In the 1600s, Martin Luther wrote a note to his publisher's son on his wedding day that gave this advice. Young man, be lord of your house, ... at least when your wife is not at home. Now, and I'm sure we're all familiar with the assertion that if the husband is the head, then the wife is the neck, turning the head wherever she wants it to go. I think those examples are just examples of the uneasiness some people feel around this issue. But when you study what the New Testament has to say to us, it says God, basically in a nutshell, it says God calls husbands to loving, sacrificial servant leadership. Husbands are called to love their wives and to love them in the same sacrificial way Christ has loved us. So husbands, you are called to lead, but you should view your role as a leader as more responsibility than privilege. See, it's more responsibility than it is privilege. So when we read that the husband is the head, it shouldn't fill us with pride. It should overwhelm us with the incredible responsibility that God has placed on our shoulders. See, there's different ways to lead. Even biblical examples. If you think of the story in the book of Esther, Esther chapter 1. The king at that time is King Ahasuerus, and he is giving this incredible feast and party for all of his officials and noblemen. And in the midst of that party that's going on, he says, I want my wife to appear, Queen Vashti, to come and appear and kind of prance before all these guys so they can see just how beautiful she is to look at. And she says, no, I'm not coming. So he has her banished from her place as queen. He institutes this decree that is to be kind of nationwide that says women will submit to their husbands. It's an example of leadership, but it's not a good example of leadership because as a husband, his interest was not what would best elevate her, but how he would look best. So different from the way that Christ has loved us and modeled what a good leading husband is supposed to look like. And I would just say if Christian husbands were more like Christ and less like Ahasuerus, maybe we would find our wives far more prepared to submit to our leadership. I remember trying to explain this to one of the young guys that we mentored as a couple through marriage preparation. He wanted to be the leader, but he thought his role as head meant that he could dictate to his wife what she could and could not eat from the dessert bar. We attended a wedding with them, and this was the debate that they had. Now, that reflects an incorrect understanding of headship. The aim of Christ's love for the church was so that he might present his bride to God. The aim of that husband was to make sure his wife didn't gain any weight. So we're called to lead as husbands, but the way that we lead is just as important as the fact that we lead. Now, Ephesians 5 also has a word to say for wives. Specifically, it says that wives are called to be respectful or are called to respectful, God-honoring submission to their husbands. It's worth noting, Paul addresses husbands and wives separately in this passage. He doesn't say, husbands, make sure your wives are submitting. And he doesn't say, wives, make sure your husbands are leading correctly. Now, this word submission is a dirty word in our day. We're hesitant to talk about it, but we shouldn't be. If you struggle with this idea as a wife, it might be worth reflecting on the fact that there is submission within the Trinity itself. Scripture is clear that the Son submits to the Father. Now, if it is not beneath the Son's dignity to submit to God the Father, then surely it should not be seen as an affront to a wife's dignity to submit to her husband's leadership. This is the call from Ephesians 5. This is the front to back dimension of a Christian marriage. Let me give you a final picture of biblical oneness. And this final dimension is best pictured as a couple standing face to face. This is the idea of intimacy in marriage. The second half of verse 24 says, "And they shall become one flesh." Verse 25 says, "And the man and his wife were both naked and felt no shame." Now, I know some of the guys are thinking, finally, this is what we want to hear about. Suddenly, this conference isn't so bad. Let me just say, these verses are not just about sex in marriage, but that's obviously part of what this oneness is supposed to look like. Truth is, it takes a lot more than just good sex to make a truly intimate marriage. Good sex is really a byproduct of intimacy that you build in your relationship. C.J. Mahaney gives some very helpful advice to husbands in this regard when he says, "Before you touch her body, touch her heart and mind." And see, couples who don't understand this in their marriage will end up in a stalemate, much like this couple. You can see he is saying no sex, no love, and she's saying no love, no sex. They will sit like that forever, each wanting their own needs met first. Just as a kind of word of encouragement to you guys, husbands, especially if you want to kind of do some thinking about this and challenge yourself a little bit, best book I can recommend on this subject is a book by C.J. Mahaney called Sex, Romance, and the Glory of God. Ties those things together in beautiful fashion. And I know as a husband, it's one of the books that challenged me greatly in terms of how I'm supposed to love my wife and lead in this way as well. Now, I already said that intimacy is about more than just sex, but sex is a powerful symbol of the one flesh relationship. It requires letting go and being completely vulnerable. And I think it's really sad that many couples in marriage don't take advantage of God's good gift more often. Sex expresses several key purposes of marriage: union, intimacy, comfort, pleasure, play, the creation of life, and protection from sexual temptation. It does all of those things for us. Now, I know this group, not all of you are married, and so this is not stuff to go out and apply right away. Song of Songs gives us a warning three times: do not arouse or awaken love until its appointed time. You need to reserve this for marriage. But certainly within marriage, this is one of God's good gifts to us. And I think too often physical intimacy is either completely neglected or it's seen as something unholy. This is not the biblical view. I want you to listen to these words of instruction penned by the wife of Reverend D.L. Smithers back in 1894. See how this would go over today. "To the sensitive young woman who has had the benefits of proper upbringing, the wedding day is ironically both the happiest and most terrifying day of her life. On the positive side, there is the wedding itself, in which the bride is the central attraction in a beautiful and inspiring ceremony, symbolizing her triumph in securing a male to provide for all her needs the rest of her life. On the negative side, there is the wedding night, during which the bride must pay the piper, so to speak. At this point, dear reader, let me concede one shocking truth. Some young women actually anticipate the wedding night with curiosity and pleasure. Beware of such an attitude. A selfish and sensual husband can easily take advantage of such a bride. One cardinal rule of marriage should never be forgotten: give little, give seldom, and above all, give grudgingly." She goes on to give some further advice. She says, "On the other hand, the bride's terror need not be extreme. While sex is at best revolting and at worst rather painful, it has to be endured and has been by women since the beginning of time. It is useless in most cases for the bride to prevail upon the groom to forego the sexual initiation. While the ideal husband would be one who would approach his bride only at her request and only for the purpose of begetting offspring, such nobility and unselfishness cannot be expected from the average man. Most men, if not denied, would demand sex almost every day. The wise bride will permit a maximum of two brief sexual experiences weekly during the first months of marriage. As time goes by, she should make every effort to reduce this frequency. Feigned illness, sleepiness, and headaches are among the wife's best friends in this matter. Arguments, nagging, scolding, and bickering also prove very effective if used in the late evening, about 1 hour before the husband would normally commence his seduction. Well, I'm glad that not all pastors' wives kind of take that approach. But this is the way that it sometimes has been in the past. But what I'm saying to you, this aspect of oneness is something that is given to us by God. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and felt no shame. Now, you want to preserve that in your marriage. You want to have a marriage that is characterized by this nakedness and no shame. I want to say, if you're not married, then wait till marriage. Save your sexual interactions until you are married. And it is a unshameful, unabashed, joyous occasion. This is the word of the scriptures. So those are your areas of oneness. What I want to do for you is just to leave you with some questions. You may not have time now to do it, but maybe you and your spouse want to spend some time this evening or later today talking about these areas. You can write these down. Just take a moment. Some questions for you to talk about in each of these four areas. The first one is, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you score your relationship in each of these four areas? Four areas, again, are this idea of back-to-back, side-by-side, front-to-back, and face-to-face. And then secondly, which area did you rate the highest? What are some of the things you're already doing to make your marriage strong in that area? Focus on some of the positives. What are the bright spots? What are the things that you really enjoy about your relationship together? It may be that you have a fantastic side-by-side marriage where you just enjoy each other's company. You love doing things together. You can strengthen some of that. And then the third question is, what area did you rate the lowest? What are some things you think you could do to strengthen your relationship in this area? It may be related to a leadership issue. It may be related to kind of you need to get back to back and fend off some things threatening you, whatever it is. Spend some time talking about that as a couple. Okay, James, what is the schedule next? How long do we have till we...